Okay, Adam, first up.
There's something in what he said that worries me. And in fact, Joy said the same thing. He said that other types of medicine, like homeopathy and acupuncture, were practiced here, so-called alternative medicine. But these are quack remedies, which don't work. These don't work according in the way that they are supposed to work. It's a pity he associates with these quacks.
Okay, Mike.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks very much, Joy. Yeah, that was very interesting. I'd heard the name Patch Adams before, but I haven't seen the film, and I sort of didn't know anything about what he's done. So yeah, thanks for giving an outline of his life and work. Yeah, it was very interesting. With what Adam said, homeopathy is non-scientific. I think with acupuncture, it seems to work, but nobody knows how, which to me suggests that both it and homeopathy are a bit like sort of placebos, really, that they and any effect they have is psychological. It seems as if that fits in with Patch Adams's sort of wider philosophy that, you know, a psychological approach to medicine through empathy is important, as well as the more sort of physical aspects of medicine and surgery. So it's possible, you know, that he sort of backed those other medical approaches because they seem to work for some people, even if they weren't on the same scientific basis as proper medicine. But yeah, I think the interesting thing for me is how he values the sort of, you know, bedside manner, for want of a better way of putting it, you know, the sort of psychological empathetic helping aspects of medicine. And I think that's something he's done, which is important, as well as sort of offering his services for free. But yeah, thank you. Yeah, cheers.
Okay, can I just come in there, Carla?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, when he was in med school, he did, you know, they have to do internships now and again, and he did one or two, one in the psychiatric ward, where most of the patients, he found out, really had emotional problems, but they were being treated medically. So they weren't being treated as human beings, and he got to know them on a personal basis, chatted to them, etc. And this was seen as being revolutionary at the time, and the doctors in charge of his studies were absolutely appalled. But I think he felt that having a, let's call it, holistic approach to medicine was a very good thing, because not everybody has got, let's say, a physical illness, but they may have some emotional problem that can be cured even if it is a placebo. If it works, so what? You know, I mean, I think that it's worth trying anything. And those people who were being treated by him were made to feel like human beings. They weren't just a medical case. And by the way, Mike, don't bother watching the film. It's terrible.
Okay, thanks, Joy. Glenn?
Hi, Joy. Thank you for that. That was very interesting. I don't think I've ever seen the film, but I remember Robin Williams, obviously, pretty well. I had one question, Joy. I don't know if you know anything about this, but I'd be interested to know what sort of reaction he got from the wider establishment, particularly the medical profession themselves. I mean, how was he viewed by people? I mean, we had the obvious thing in the Oprah Winfrey show when she ridiculed and mentioned his socks cost money and all that nonsense.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
What sort of reaction did he get from the establishment?
Well, I can only really tell you what the reaction was when he was a medical student, and that was they tried to kick him out of med school quite a few times because they deemed his practice to be unorthodox, not the norm, etc., etc. So let's say that the old establishment were very much anti his methodology, call it that. Now, I don't know what the wider medical establishment thought later on when he actually qualified and was running the Gesundheit Institute. But as he said, thousands of people were coming to them. You know, they were treating 500 to 1,000 people a week. That's all I can say about that, Glenn.
Has that answered you, Glenn?
Oh, sorry, yes. Sorry, I was on mute. Thank you, Joy. I mean, it is interesting that, I mean, I think the sad thing that I immediately got from watching that was how, if you like, people with these sorts of views, and I'm pretty sure socialists are treated the same way, is there's a sense of sort of ridicule and comic thing that kicks in so quickly, and you know, the audience all laughing, and I think that's terribly sad, really. And I'm sure we've all experienced something rather similar. But I did wonder, you know, addressing that wider question about the establishment. I mean, clearly, no one's going to like the fact that someone's operating without, you know, looking at it with a business model, and, you know, where in reality it's got very little to do with patient health. It's all about the money. But I'd be interested to know from, you know, if anyone else knows about him and you know, just what that reaction was. I can imagine what it was, in all honesty. I mean, he would have been pushing against the closed door a lot of the time. Yeah. But thanks, Joy. That was great. Okay. Thank you.
Jane, Tony?
I was curious to know if there's any information about who his actual clients were. I mean, it says they come from all over, which implies, well, if you're very poor in America, from all over. So it's my suspicion. And whether... when he started, it was a kind of small establishment. Was it just actually targeted at local people in that area, or was it actually a broad thing that was open to all comers, if you like? I.e., was there any class significance in it?
I don't think so. I mean, sorry, do you want to carry on?
Yeah, did poor people use it predominantly, or was it just anybody who didn't want to pay for their medicine?
I don't really think it's a question of people who didn't want to pay. I mean, he did say that the cost of getting to stay there was less than a day's stay in an American hospital.
Yeah.
No, I think, I mean, in theory, the hospital was open to everybody. And if people heard about it, they wouldn't want to go there.
Okay, Tony, has that answered you?
It'll do. Yeah, okay. Yeah, not really, but I think probably we don't have an answer, so that's okay.
Howard?
Sorry, I wasn't going to say this, but just to say, I thought the video answered Tony's question. He said it was open to anyone at all who wanted to come, that the cost of getting there was less than staying for a day in an ordinary hospital. So the chances are that people who came, I would think, were people who couldn't afford an ordinary hospital. And he did specifically say that it wasn't just for local people, it was for anyone. Clearly, America's a big place. So, for some people, it would have been impossible. But anyway, no, what I was going to mention was that it relates to what Adam and Mike said earlier about, or what Mike said in particular, about the connection between the emotional and the physical. I mean, I think it's widely accepted amongst most medics these days that there can be and often is a connection between emotional upset and possible physical illness. I mean, emotional upset is known to have sort of sometimes severe physical effects. And therefore, I think, you know, this does tie in with what Patch Adams was and is doing, the idea that, by making people feel better, if you like, and by perhaps somehow getting to the root of their problems, their emotional problems, this could have a beneficial effect on their physical illness. I mean, some people would go a lot further than just that. They'd say that, you know, most physical illnesses are caused by the issues, the upsets that people have in their personal lives, especially ones that they cannot reveal to anyone, and that's, you know, the background to counselling and the various therapies that that are now available in most medical services. So I don't think it's as black and white as to say, you know, those remedies that Adam mentioned are quack things and don't work. There may be a good reason why some of them sometimes do work.
Thanks, Hard. I wanted to say something. You've just reminded me that when he was doing an internship in a children's hospital, the kids were just all virtually mute, lying in bed all day, just wasting away, some of them. And one of his approaches was to come in wearing a clown's costume, mm-hmm. big red nose, and go around and make the children laugh.
It's, if you can finish it, yes.
Sorry, I heard a bit of background noise. He started making the children laugh and enjoy themselves and get out of bed and play, and found that their recovery was much quicker than it would normally have been if they'd just been treated for the actual medical condition which they were deemed to have.
Okay, is it my turn? Right, actually, I just wanted to echo Howard, sorry, that Adam calling these people quacks, I think, is really unhelpful and really closed-minded. On what authority does he have to say these people are quacks? Anyway, that's my personal issue. Joy, I wondered when I don't think that Oprah was actually taking the piss out of him. Right. I think she was kind of asking him in a roundabout way. Well, you've got to pay for your clothes. How do you live? And in fact, I was wondering the very same thing. How did these people, how did these doctors manage? It's all very well giving your time and giving your and being a doctor and doing things for free, but you also have to feed your family. And apart from having a job and giving some time to this, I mean, how, you know, was it a charity? It's obviously he's fundraising, so I'm assuming it was a charity, and I'm assuming that these doctors were paid. Is that right, Joy, or?
I don't think that's right to start with. I mean, he started the fundraising a long time after the Gesundheit Institute was first established, and he and his wife, who was also a medic, they started running the hospital from their own home, and all the medical professionals gave their time and expertise for free, but they also had people living there in a sort of communal way, growing vegetables and doing the cooking and the washing up and that sort of thing. So they were, I think, mostly self-sufficient.
Okay, but when they got bigger, you know, when it got sort of, did it ever get bigger?
No, unfortunately, that's the big problem. It never did get bigger. When he realised that what they needed was a larger model, that they needed to do something that was a large hospital that would take, say, 40 people, that's when he started doing the fundraising and, you know, going around the world and sort of promoting his ideas.
Okay, thanks, Joy. Yeah. Paul? Paul's up.
Yeah, I just finished reading a book about undocumented people in the United States, of whom apparently there are around 11 million, mostly of Latinx backgrounds. And being undocumented means it's virtually impossible for them to buy health insurance. So I wonder if perhaps those are some of the patients that Dr. Adams treats. The book also says that undocumented people had to use sort of unofficial ways to get hold of medicine. So some pharmacies will unofficially sell them medicines and so on at a cheap rate, even though they don't have a prescription for them. And also some official residents pretend to have illnesses so they can get a prescription for them and then pass the medicines on to undocumented people. So I would, obviously, I don't know, but I would guess that undocumented people who can't get health care otherwise might well be among Dr. Adams' patients.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right, Paul.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Paddy? Sorry, Paul, do you want to come back?
I'm just about to say I've drafted a review of the book, so you might be able to read about it if it gets published, yeah.
Paddy?
I was interested that at one point Adams, Patch Adams says, or said, that he had enough staff for 5 hospitals, suggesting that he had absolutely no shortage of volunteers, despite, you know, all the problems that people have in capitalism with having to work, having to make a living. It reminded me, it was a bit like, I remember once looking into trying to get a teaching job at Summerhill, which a lot of people have probably heard of. It's a kind of free school in the sense that it democratizes the education process. And there's quite a few of these. They're not free as in you don't pay anything, but they're free in a democracy sense, so that the kids all choose their own, you know, what they want to learn or if they want to learn anything and this sort of thing. So there's a few of these. Dartington Hall's another one. And I remember looking into this, well, years and years ago, but there was a massive waiting list. I mean, basically, it was like a year's waiting list. People, you know, teachers were absolutely queuing up to get jobs in these schools because the working environment worlds away from what it is in your average coercive state school, and people couldn't, you know, desperate to get work in this place. So I can easily imagine, you know, that he had a lot of medical staff who were willing to do this sort of work for nothing. They just couldn't actually build the facilities and stuff to do it. But you know what this makes me think, and it also made me think that I think there's a if you can sort of verify this if you Google the size of the volunteer workforce in various countries. In the USA, I seem to remember reading the size of the volunteer workforce is bigger than US Steel and General Motors combined, and worldwide it's about the size of the population of China. You could basically, if you took all those volunteers worldwide, they could basically run all the essential services in socialism, even if nobody else got out of bed or did anything. That's about less than a fifth of the world's population could easily cover all the essential services, even if no one else did anything. So it's absolutely huge. The amount of people who do voluntary work in capitalism, which makes no logical sense, but they do it anyway, is absolutely huge. And I thought that Joy picked a really, really good example. This is a really refreshing subject, which I think we don't really make enough of in the party. I think, you know, the altruistic side of human behaviour, the way that people have got this sort of determination very often to behave like decent human beings in an indecent social system. People, you know, this kind of unconquerable desire to do the right thing and to do the right thing by other people and to give your efforts for free. It's really quite amazing that you see that at all in capitalism, but the fact that you see it so much is quite astonishing. And we don't make enough of it, I think, in the party. It's a way of, and I think what Joy's picked up on here is a much more positive approach to putting the socialist case than our default standby tactic, which is, you know, concentrating on all the negatives and banging on about how all the bad things that go on in the world that everybody knows anyway, which probably ends up accidentally perpetuating a constant sense of, you know, dismal futility and hopelessness. So I think well done to Joy for picking this subject. It's something that I think the rest of us, you know, really ought to look into and do more of. So, you know, let's have more of this sort of thing.
Oh, thanks, Paddy. Actually, I was talking to Howard before I came on air, as it were. I just remembered something that was a personal experience of mine, that I work as a volunteer in a charity shop one day a week. And many years ago, we had the most vile manageress. She was an absolute bitch, unpleasant, rude, didn't like what she was doing. She treated the volunteer staff like dirt. I mean, she would swear at us in front of customers, you know. One day she actually threw something at one of the volunteers in the shop and everybody absolutely despised her and nobody quit the job. Nobody quit. We all used to say, what crap, I hate that bitch, etc., etc. But nobody gave in because we all believed in what we were doing. It's a local hospice. Everybody's known somebody who's had a relative or a friend who's died there. And we were all so devoted to the hospice and making it work and getting money, that nobody quit, even though we suffered 8 hours a day when she was there.
Okay, thanks. Moggy? Moggy's up next.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, well, that was quite an eye-opener. I have seen the film, and the film was indeed played for laughs and didn't make it clear about the voluntary work that the medical staff were doing. So I learned a lot from this morning's talk. But the thing is, I do believe that laughter is a very good medicine. And so I think that's you can consider that an alternative medicine. And I don't believe that all alternative medicine practitioners are quacks. I think some are just psychosomatic or money-making things. Like, I've never had any faith in homeopathy, but I do believe in herbal medicine, and I myself have had good results from herbal medicine where I've not from having drugs that the doctor's given me. So I think that there's a lot to be said for various types of alternative medicine. Also, I do believe that Oprah, when she's doing interviews, she does not take the piss out of people. It is the job of every television interviewer and good journalist to act as devil's advocate and ask the questions that they know the general public want answers to. So she was not trying to send him up or anything. She was trying to get to the bottom of it. And I think she does that very, very well. So that's one thing. And I think you do get a lot of volunteers wanting to help when you're doing this sort of thing. It's what people want to do. They don't always want to be doing a job where they're getting money for it. And I remember an example of 20 or 25 years ago when Britain had a very bad, I think it was a foot and mouth epidemic. And a lot of New Zealand vets went over there to help. They weren't getting paid for it, but they would, you know, take it in turn to go over for 3 weeks and come back. And then another one would go for 3 weeks and come back. And they worked incredibly hard while they were there. So it's not just medicine for people. It's wherever there's a need, I think people will jump in and do it. But what our job as socialists is to convince people that we shouldn't have to do this. If it's free all the time, then you don't have to look at examples of people who are standing out as being different and helping, because everybody would do it. So, you know, that's me. Thank you.
Yeah, well said, Moggy. Do you want to comment, Joy?
No, that was great.
Okay. Glenn, you want to, as an observation you've got?
Yeah, Carla, thanks. Yeah, only because of this, I feel very much in agreement with Paddy in terms of how the socialist case is presented. I really do. And I think some of that came out at the conference in Birmingham, or this summer school, I should say. But just as a very brief comment here, I've started reading. I'm about a quarter of the way through this book, but forgive me if any of you know it. And forgive me, Adam, if it's been reviewed in the journal, I've missed it. But I'm reading it now, and I have to say, I think everybody who has an interest in socialism or shares the view of socialists should read this book. It's called Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. And it's, I won't say any more about it, because perhaps we can look, if Adam, if it's not in the journal, I'm happy to do a review of it. But it's called The Humankind, Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. Absolutely astonishing. I guess Howard just put a comment out. Maybe he's already reviewed it. Forgive me if I've missed it, Adam, but I really do think socialists should read this book. And it basically, what it does is it blows out of the water this idea that people are naturally aggressive and selfish and all the rest of it. And he does a lot of very, very good research, and a great book. I won't say any more than that. Just have it in mind.
Okay. A comrade has just put, can you put the link up, Glenn?
Sorry, I just muted myself. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll email Paddy with it, because he's far more technically minded than me. And okay. And then I'm sure he'll do it if he doesn't mind.
I'm sure he won't mind. Okay. Freddie, did you want to say something? Freddie? Okay. Howard?
No need for the link. The book was reviewed in the Standard in May of this year. You've not been reading it closely enough, Glenn. It was actually reviewed by me.
Who reviewed it? Everyone's got to read it.
I think it is, yes. It is quite an extraordinary book, although in the end it doesn't quite go far enough, as I said in the final paragraph. It doesn't make the sort of the final leap that we need a completely different kind of economic and social organization. But never mind, it's extremely helpful, no doubt about that. But the reason I put the question, I was going to put the question on, was that I just wanted to refer to the point made earlier in the talk, in Joy's talk, about the reasons why people sort of do things for others. I think the expression she used was the twin reasons, if you like, of empathy and personal satisfaction or the approbation of others, something like that. And I think that summed it up very well, really, because you know, we do things for others because they're human beings, and if they need things to be done, you know, we sort of almost, and Bregman says this actually, we naturally, viscerally want to help, although circumstances can sort of, you know, make us behave differently. And also it's very, very nice, most people will admit, if others approve of what we've done, if we get so the approbation of us, it gives us tremendous personal satisfaction. I don't think anyone would, even the sort of cruelest individual would deny that, that there is personal satisfaction to be gained from helping others who need a particular kind of help. And I think, you know, I'll link it again to Bregman's book. I think Bregman's book makes the reasons for that clear, and the origins of it clear as well. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Howard. Okay, Adam's just put the link to Howard's review up in the speaking queue. Okay, Mark, would you like to come in?
Yes, so thanks very much, Joy. I probably had heard of Patch Adams, but I didn't know anything about him. And funnily enough, although I like... I've watched a lot of, if not as many as I could, of Robin Williams' films. I didn't watch that particular one. So in combination with you drawing this a very interesting person and his his motivations and history to our attention, I also want to say how much I appreciate what Paddy said, kind of generalizing that in terms of how we address the question of capitalism. And I think probably the fact that I'd never heard of Patch Adams may well be a personal issue that I tend to look at things perhaps more in sort of abstract theoretical issues, and the human side of things perhaps isn't something that drives me as much. And that may be also something that perhaps is characteristic of a number of, you know, members of the party. And I don't mean that to be critical of anyone. I just mean that, you know, so that we think, if we talk about human nature, you know, if I talk about human nature, I tend to try to talk about it sort of abstractly. And yet this is very concrete. And you hear something very concrete like this, and it's compelling and convincing. But also perhaps not just a personal, it's not just perhaps a personal issue, but I think that obviously that the system has an interest in us not being, not those things not being drawn to our attention. Now, of course, you know, there it is, there it was on Oprah Winfrey, but not being put out all the time as being admirable. We have, you know, the model of doing good very often tends to be corporate social responsibility, with companies doing it and people. And even in those things, there is definitely some human altruism, but it's all, you know, it's all distorted greatly. And one of the things about this character, this Patch Adams, I the interview was so beautiful because he's so carefree about what he's doing. I mean, he, in the sense that he was so joyous about it and really just didn't care what other people thought, and felt free for not having all the concerns over, you know, the usual concerns that many doctors have of, you know, building their private, their big houses, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, the refreshingness of it was great. And I so much appreciate that. And also I thought was interesting, and something that no one's mentioned yet, is that he was asked about his own inspirations. And he didn't just mention, you know, just altruism per se, but he also mentioned the anti-war movement. I think it was the anti-war movement and some other movements, some other movements contesting various aspects of power in capitalism. And it's also encouraging to know that, you know, none of those things necessarily, and none of our actions will just disappear, but, you know, they are like stones thrown into lakes where ripples occur, and the occasional person may be inspired to do something, you know, unusual, and then they themselves will be an inspiration. I wonder whether he doesn't belong in that, and maybe I'm taking a step too far here, but maybe he belongs in that category of the utopian socialists that, you know, Engels wrote about. I don't know, was it Robert Owen, you know, the ones who went and built in America model villages, trying to create a utopia in the midst of capitalist, you know, capitalist society. You know, obviously that doesn't have any possibility of success, but on the other hand, it did give great inspiration, even to, you know, to Marx and Engels, who often referred to such people not only critically but also positively. So. Yeah, thank you very much. And it's great. And that's one of the great things about being in the party, where one comrade, you know, has a certain interest and can really lay that out well. And another comrade has another interest that, you know, for example, I would never have by myself. But here we are talking about these things because we are a party where we're committed to a certain end. But there are so many ways of thinking about that, and we can riff off each other. So that's really great. So thank you very much, Joy. And thanks also to Paddy, because I thought that was a great intervention.
Can I say a word there?
Yeah, go ahead, Joy.
Right, first of all, dziękuję kochani Marejczyk. And Patch Adams, yes. Yeah. I was going to say Paddy. He did actually say when Williams died that he was immensely sorry, because they had become friends, in fact. And, you know, he did praise Williams for his generosity of spirit, let's say. That during filming, Williams did go down to his hospital and talk to patients and, you know, try to cheer them up. You know, he was a clown anyway. So when Williams died, which was tragically young, obviously, Adams did make a point of writing a very beautiful eulogy about him, which I think is on Wikipedia. I think it is. Anyway, as for the film, Marejczyk, don't bother.
Okay, if I can pop in here. I don't know if any comrades are familiar with the Money Free Party, but a couple of years ago, obviously before lockdown, the chap put out a couple of videos, and one video was he was Nick Tapping was actually interviewing people in the street, and he was asking them, he was saying, if you could get everything for free, if you could live for free, would you work for free? Now, obviously, some of them needed this explaining. What do you mean? You know, what do you mean if I can live for free? Well, if you can get your food and your housing and your bills, and you didn't have to pay for anything, would you give your work for free? And in fact, once they thought about it, most of these people he interviewed, obviously, he's not going to interview people that told him to F off. But, I mean, you know, most of these people actually said, yes, they would. So I think, you know, once people got their head round it, why wouldn't you? Thanks.
Quite right.
Dougie.
Hi. I hope you can hear me, because I'm up in my bedroom because I've got a friend staying at the moment. And anyway, I missed most of the beginning, right, because I had my friend over and I thought I'd come in and talk. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I know Adam calls some of these things quack remedies, and there is a lot of evidence that, you know, homeopathy is no better than placebos. But there's been a lot of studies on placebos that they actually do have a positive effect on people. And I can only talk about drugs from the psychiatric profession, because I suffer from schizophrenia, so I take drugs for that. And some of these drugs are so obnoxious, when you take a lot of them, you just can't think straight, really, you know. And I spent a long time reducing the drug so that I could get my brain back in gear, you know. And also, when I was in hospital, a lot of people had ECT, and that's electric shock. Oh, God. And they gave it to a lot of people for depression. And I seen people coming in, getting ECT, going out, and then about 3 weeks later, coming back in, depressed again, really, you know. I mean, I know I've friends or psyche nurses, and some of them swear by ECT for depression, but nobody knows how it works, and it does affect your short-term memory. And previous to that, there was lobotomies and all sorts of things that they did on mental patients. But I mean I'm just rambling a bit, but I mean as far as volunteers concerned, I work with people in the Oxfam shop, really, you know, and it's brilliant, really, you know, working with volunteers, and the manager's really nice, and, you know, we have a good time, and I think a lot of people would volunteer in socialism, and we'd probably have too many people wanting to volunteer and not enough work, probably, yeah.
Thanks, Dougie. Freddie?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, good to hear you.
Listen, I'd pulled into a service station when I submitted that bit about hear, Paddy, and I've pulled into a lay-by just to make a comment and endorsing that which Paddy had said, that I think at times we should be concentrating more and we, what the working class do. I know that we've previously discussed on Discord this concept of the tens and tens of thousands of volunteers throughout the world who freely give up their time to do things that they find of interest that generally can be socially beneficial. And I do think we should concentrate on that. And I'm particularly pleased. I've seen that film, although it was some time ago, about Patch Hardens, and I didn't realise this. I thought it was a good film. At least my recollection of it is I thought it was a good film. And thank Joy for actually raising that. And I think that those people that were in the audience laughing at some of what he was saying. The people that should be laughed at is those that were pathetic enough to be laughing at some that is trying to do some social good. You know, we can pick faults with lots of different things at times. Someone is trying to do some social good, even if it's not necessarily socialist and its principle, but the tens of millions of people throughout the world who are trying to do some social good. I would say let's try and do a bit more on that. And when referencing back to the Birmingham Weekend School, there was, I know that was the first time I've ever attended that particular event. And it was sort of joyous listening to some of the comrades at the time there. Particularly in the social events after the addresses that were being given, the sort of commonality of thought on, yeah, let's try and concentrate a bit more on the good that people are doing. Capitalism is horrendous. We know that. We know capitalism is horrendous. And despite all of that, the people still try and do good wherever possible. So if I've rambled on a bit, I'm sorry, but that's the way I feel about it. And but thanks, Joy. I thought that was a good, good address, and well done for bringing it along. Good night, all.
Thanks, Freddie.
Thanks, Freddie, and drive carefully. Paddy? Paddy?
Hi, Carla, your mention of the Money Free Party I thought was interesting, and it reminded me that years ago, I think it was on YouTube, but I saw this video where this somebody just went on the New York subway and randomly went up to people sat on the subway on the way to work and stuff and said, excuse me, do you mind if I ask you a question? What would you do if you won a million or 10 million, I forget what it was, on the lottery? What would you do the next day? And so they had a load of responses for this. Presumably they probably edited out a few unflattering responses, but quite a lot of people said, oh, well, if I won the lottery, I've always wanted to do voluntary work because, to help other people, because that's a great thing to do. And I'd definitely do that if I didn't have to work for a living. I have no idea where that video is now, but it did occur to me that one of the things that we ought to think about doing. Sorry, I'm just going to close Freddie off, right? One of the things we could do is, why don't we go out on the street and do videos like this and ask people this question? What would you do if everything was free? You didn't have to pay for anything, and any work that you did was voluntary. What would you choose to do? Instead of sort of raking through YouTube, trying to find videos that other people might have done, why don't we try and go out and do it ourselves? Anyway, that's my point.
That's exactly what I was thinking when I saw that video, Paddy. That's exactly what I was thinking. Why don't we do that? Thanks. Mark?
Yes, I wanted to bring a kind of a counter example or counter situation, and it relates to Poland, and, Joy already greeted me in Polish, And it's something that's been on my heart over the last few days. I don't know how many of you know that on the border of between Poland and Belarus right now, there are a number, we're talking, let's say 20, 30, 40 refugees from Afghanistan and from Iraq. And they are like caught in no man's land between Belarus and Poland, and the role of the Polish authorities has been, leaving aside the role of the Belarusian authorities, which I can't really comment on, but the role of the Polish authorities has been really quite disgusting, because they basically have prevented any thing being delivered to these refugees. Food, tents, and everything like that. That may have changed in the last couple of days due to the European Union getting involved. But they were not allowing people to go over to them to do anything. And so you had these poor people freezing cold, and they're surrounded by these guards. And it was really very, 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 very heavy and depressing, and distressing, frankly. And you know, the Polish Prime Minister said that we must protect Poland's holy land, and actually used the term holy. And the narrative that is being spun out is, one, that it's a provocation by the Belarusian authorities, and two, that these are potentially terrorists and they are Muslims, et cetera, et cetera. The usual but very powerful kind of narratives being told. And there are lots of people in Poland, I mean, lots of them who desperately want to help these people. And there have been lots of attempts to help these people. But on the other hand, when opinion polls seem to indicate, and it doesn't surprise me, that there is a definite majority of people who have been asked in these opinion polls that they definitely would believe that these people should not be helped. These people should not be, because they bought into the story that these people, children, women, you know, they represent a threat to us. And so there's a large percentage, but it's a minority who think that they should be helped and they should be received into Poland. And it just strikes me as being that the point I wanted to make was that this is part of the challenge that we face, which is that the ruling class, the capitalist media, has the ability to not allow people to look at those people as people. They are enemies. They are a threat. They are a danger. Our land is holy. And it's amazing, but that gains traction. And I think part of the issue is that people don't operate in an abstract way, that they're asked if you were living in a world of plenty, et cetera, et cetera. They're actually living, many of them, with themselves, with existential fears, which makes them very manipulable in the hands of the manipulators. And I think this is one of the things that does lead to someone like a Patch Adams. He's an unusual person who's gone against the trend, and what we're calling on people actually is to go against the trend. I mean, to think against the trend. And I think that's the big challenge that, you know, and I don't want to be depressing. I just want to, but we're faced with the question of how can you get a majority of people to go against the trend in a society which is controlled very powerfully by people who spend all of their life forcing people to stay within the trend. And that's what's happening in Poland right now, and which means that individual people are suffering due to that.
Thanks, Mark. Okay, Adam.
Yeah, I just want to follow on from what Mark has said, because a similar situation occurred in Britain a few weeks ago, didn't it? When I think it was Nigel Farage criticised the lifeboat people for helping and picking up these people trying to cross the channel. And one result of this was, I think, that the voluntary donations to the RNLI went up. So people with that attitude might be a minority, but it's quite a large minority, I think.
Howard, you need to unmute.
Sorry, Carla. I was just starting to say that, to go off on a bit of a tangent, a couple of people, including you, Carla, I think, have mentioned the Money Free Party. I see their posts sometimes on Facebook, and they seem to be sort of saying the same thing as us. I mean, do you, Carla, or does anyone else know anything more about them and the extent to which, you know, we should be sort of getting closer than we are?
Ex-comrade Dave Chesham actually knew all about the main person there. Well, I say the main person, Nick Tapping. It's a very small party. And I've actually spoken to him, I mean, not physically spoken to him, but spoken to him on Facebook. And he's got nothing but respect for the party. And he says there, and in fact tells people that they, that the, in theory, I mean, with the theory, no one is better on the theory of socialism than we are. But I suspect that he probably thinks that he didn't extrapolate, but I think he thinks that we're going about it the wrong way, or I don't know. I really don't know. But yes, that he basically is a socialist, as far as I can tell.
You say, Carla, the main person, which suggests there are very few of them in that case.
There are very few of them, probably even less than us.
Okay, all right.
But there is apparently, there is a companion party. I know there is a lot of Australians that comment, so I think there might be a couple of people in Australia as well.
And I've seen a reference somewhere to the Money Free Party in New Zealand. So right. Maybe they've got some people there.
Yeah, I think, well, it might have been New Zealand and not Australia then, but yeah. Okay, anyone else would like to comment or ask Joy a question? Steve?
Yeah, thanks. Just to add something into us about motivation. Of course, there is this wonderful potential that we have as individuals in a social for development, which is completely denied to the majority, well, to the working class, because we've always got to be thinking about how am I going to earn, you know, unlike Patch Adams, we might not have access to so many acres of land to set up some sort of self-sufficient commune. So we're as members of the working class in capitalism, we are essentially we would seem like very poor human beings to someone that's lived in a socialist society. People will have the opportunity to develop themselves in so many different ways, whether it in some sort of practical skills or in some that the sort of things that majority of us don't get any access to. So there's that positive aspect as to the way that humans live or will live in a socialist. But we don't need to, but we've got another string to the bow, if you like, which is that socialism for us workers is in our direct self-interest, so that we know that as profitless workers, we've got no potential for stability. We're always in a precarious situation by the very nature of capitalism itself, because it's always going to be a system which is dislocated. It's always going to be a system which is seeking to reduce our skills, reduce our wage levels, and so on and so forth. And so So whilst we might have let's call it a sort of higher motive, a humanity motive for being socialist, we've also got that direct economic motive that we cannot satisfy in a rational way our direct economic needs whilst we've got capitalism. So we shouldn't forget that. Certainly, positive put to people. It's in your own interest. And history's shown over the last 150 years under capitalism that it cannot be reformed on a sustained, on a long-term basis. Always work against us. That's me. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. That's interesting, because I remember having a conversation with a comrade, and I think it was he was saying that we aren't necessarily altruistic. The fact is that I guess it's like saying we can't be free until everybody's free. So in other words, you know, it is in our own interest, in our own selfish interest for socialism. But by that very fact, that it means it's in everyone's interest. So, you know, unless I can't be free if everyone is not free.
Quite so, which is why I opened the liberation of the entire human race.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Adam.
Yeah, you missed me out. I was going to say something about, could go back about Nick.
Sorry, Adam.
Nick Tappin. He was on our old WSM forum about 10 or 15 years ago, and he was very hostile to us at that moment. I can't remember what he was about. He was a bit of a nuisance. So obviously, the arguments we had with him then have convinced him, and he's mellowed. But I would think that the difference between the Money Free Party and us would be, I think they might envisage it existing only in one country, and they don't, of course, have a class analysis, so they're not appealing to the working class as defined by us even, but they're appealing to all people of goodwill. I would agree with you. He is a socialist, but he's a utopian socialist. And the other thing is, when they've contested elections, they get as many votes as we do.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Maybe we can convince him to come and give us a talk on his version of, well, what his party stands for. Be interesting. He's a fellow. Oh, I can't use that fellow traveller, can I? I can't use that. Sorry.
Good idea.
Okay, well, go on. Sorry, Adam.
Yeah, you can invite him if you want to. I don't know how you get in touch with him. Somebody gives me his email. He must be on Facebook, isn't he? He's on our Facebook page, so we can somebody can send him a message and ask him.
Yeah. Okay. Steve.
Yeah, just very quickly, I've just remembered about 6 months ago. I had a look at this. They've got a Bristol branch. This Money Free Party. Basically, it's the usual. Reformist hodgepodge stuff, but yeah, I mean, it'd be very interesting to get some of these people in, but don't have too much faith in the fact that they're quite close to us. I don't think they are, from what I've seen. But anyway, okay.
Hey, Richard.
Oh, hi. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep, can hear you.
Yep, great, lovely. I just wanted to add the Money Free Party, they're very, very closely linked with the Venus Project and the Zeitgeist Movement, Peter Joseph's lot. So they very much follow his kind of thinking on their basic policy. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Anyone else? Joy, would you like to sum up or say come in again?
Yeah. Okay, well, where shall I start? Thank you very much, everybody, for attending tonight. And I might not be so terrified another time of doing a talk. I do exhort everybody to go and find some more clips of Patch Adams talking on YouTube, because he's really worth watching. And that's it. Thank you, everybody. I've enjoyed myself.
Thank you, Joy. And if there are no more questions or comments, maybe we should call it an evening.
Thanks very much, Carla. Joy.
Yes, thank you, Joy.
Thank you.